From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Millions of Americans travel every year, pack their bags, get on planes, arrive somewhere near or far away. But in a world of look-alike hotels, familiar spas, and manicured beaches, are we really going anywhere at all? Yeah, we need the break, if we can get it. But what about real, old-fashioned, so-gone-you're-lost, way-out-there, wing-and-a-prayer travel? The sojourn, the pilgrimage. My guest today says we're losing it. This hour, On Point, real travel. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's get a little way-out sound with us here. Here's a little bit of the song of the Batwa people in southwest Uganda. Okay, and maybe if you're out there hearing that, maybe you're really traveling, maybe you're not, maybe you're package toured right into the middle of it. Joining me now is Ilan Stabans. He's a professor in Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College, co-author of an essay this month headlined Reclaiming Travel in the New York Times. It's at our website, onpointradio.org. Ilan Stabans, welcome back to On Point.
It's a pleasure, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So the title here is Reclaiming Travel, but people travel a lot. What's happening? What's not happening?
Well, what is happening is that we are part of a massive movement, people moving all over the world. Last year, according to the United Nations, there were a billion tourist arrivals. 200 million people live outside their country of birth. And at the same time, we always seem not to be leaving home. The farther we go, the closer we are to our own environment. There is something fake, I would call it fake experience, in the idea that on jumping on a plane or on a train or in our car and traveling miles and miles away, we arrive at a place that ends up being quite familiar, as if we had never left. It seems to me that it is a moment, at least in my own experience, to engage in a conversation, individual, with a family, with a group, with a nation, as a society, as a culture, of what is it that we do when we travel somewhere else. What is the difference between a tourist and a traveler? I am both. I have traveled for the pleasure of being at a hotel with friends, and the traveler, on the other hand, I have also been that. It's less about the enrichment, the taking of a photograph, than it is about the loss, the confusion, the disorientation. And I think that the travel industry and culture as a whole often sells us the idea of enrichment as this only solution, the only approach to the idea of transportation from one place to another as a vacation, when it is essential that each of us finding our own key, our own cue, would go to a place and engage with that place and feel that we don't belong, that we are out of place. And that sensation of not being, not knowing, not engaging is crucial, and it is growth and diminishment at the same time, Tom.
Maybe this is something to do with globalization. I mean, you're talking about, you're saying miles alone, even thousands of miles, don't make it the kind of travel you're looking for. What? Because you can go the other side of the world, but you're in a Hyatt, or you're in a Hilton, or you're, I don't know, you've got all the, you know, you've left home, maybe a long way from home, but you still got so much familiarity if you're in that bubble.
I don't want to generalize, because I know all of us, by definition, are travelers, even if we never leave our own town. And each of our experiences is different. I am talking here about two degrees of travel, or two degrees of experience. And one, obviously, is the outside one, the engagement of that we have with the world. But the other one is internal. And I'm thinking here also, Tom, about the travel, the journeys that we had in literature, or that we have in art, that give us a sense of odyssey, of discovery, of also confronting our own limitations, our own handicaps, of realizing that we are not in control. And what worries me the most as a traveler and as a tourist is the idea that travel and tourism today are about control, are about having everything as we want it, when we want it, and that the idea of surprise, the idea of not being in control is incredibly frightening. But in the end, that is what travel seems to me to be closer to, this sense of not being who we are and testing those limits and then coming back home and being able to say, I learned by realizing what those limits are.
You put us up against some pretty high-level literary and historic examples here. I mean, Gilgamesh and the Odyssey and right on down that line, sort of biblical sojourners and pilgrims. I don't know. Even I was thinking of Jonah and the whale when I read this. I mean, those are epic. Those are, you know, mythological even. What are the elements of those travels that you think we ought to be looking for if we want that full experience?
It would be foolish to pretend that every journey, every travel, every tourist experience would have an epic component. The epic, the heroic, is within us, but it has also a time and a place in our life and in the moment in which we and in the space we engage with other societies. Not every travel would have those components, but those components are also important. And literature is a depository of memory. It is who we were before we became who we are today. And the Bible, Gilgamesh, the Odyssey, Don Quixote, are expressions of journeys of quests to understand your place in society, buildings, travels that have to do with the building of a new religion or of a new culture, and in the case of Don Quixote, a book that I feel very close to, travels that have to do with the sense that the world that surrounds us is broken and that there is something, a dream in us, a desire to mend it that will force us to leave the books, the comfort of our house, and engage with our world outside. We are not literary characters, but literature is a way of understanding what has come before us and what we're leaving behind for the future. And we see journeys in literature. We see those explorations. And as such, it is very important to me because I often travel with a book, and I often travel with a piece of paper or an iPad where I write my experiences, that the connection between the experience itself and the thoughts that result from that experience is not divorced. It is intimate. And I wanted in this essay, together with my co-writer Joshua Ellison, to show that there is an alternative to the tourist industry that we have today in which we all participate and that is built on money and money that defines societies in many ways. It alters societies. It also helps societies. In no way am I trying to suggest here that the modern world is the end of travel and that we have come because of globalization to a moment in we are absolutely disconnected from who we are. I do think that through globalization and through technology, we can find different ways of approaching. The cover of the New Yorker this week is ironically very connected to this. It is a family of four, the father, the mother, and the two kids who are in an island somewhere, but all with their iPads and iPhones, talking to somebody else, not really connecting to the beach where they are.
You and Joshua write that the world has become a frighteningly small place. Why is that? Because we are smaller, less ambitious, or it's more homogeneous? Where's the frightening smallness come from?
Well, technology, Tom, as you know, makes everything immediate. We turn the television on and we can be in the Bahamas. We turn the radio on and we can hear the music of Africa. We go to a movie and we are in Latin America. We are, that is, we are experiencing what the people in those regions are like. But are we experiencing it directly, or is this a mediated process? In going to those places, we're not going to find what we see on television or what we're going to see in the movies or on the internet. What are we going to find? Is it something manufactured that has been ready-made in order for us to find pleasure? Or are we going to go out and look for it? Look for what? Something that we are expecting to find or something that is unexpected, that we don't know about, that is going to surprise us? Will it ultimately turn into an experience that we will bring back home through anecdotes, through photographs, and tell our neighbors and family? Or will it be something that we might be embarrassed by? That is the element of surprise. I think the world is smaller because of how close things are today, because of how in contact we are through media to the different regions of the world. But the world seems at the same time vast, infinite, full of possibility if we're ready to take it. There are many people that are traveling in the right way today, and there are many of us who are not, who need to reconnect, to reclaim the idea of travel.
Ilan Stobbins and Joshua Ellison write, "We travel to transcend our own limitations. Travel should be an art through which our restlessness finds expression. We must bring back the ideal of travel as search." But they say modern tourism does not promise transformation, but rather the possibility of leaving home and coming back without any significant change or challenge. Ilan Stobbins, it's great to have you with us. Please stand by. We're talking this hour about real travel. Is all travel packaged up now, even if it's not a package tour? What about you? When did you last really travel? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with a little bit of Brad Paisley. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about real travel, travel versus tourism maybe, and whether real, deep, lose yourself to find yourself travel is something we do anymore. Of course, there's an industry that would like us to see travel in a certain way. Here's a Royal Caribbean Cruise Line commercial. In it, the sea calls people all around the country, beckons them to visit.
I want you to close your eyes and imagine you're out in the middle of me. The traffic noise, not there. The gentle sound of me puts you at ease. You can get a massage. You can go to amazing restaurants.
Yeah.
Surfing, zip line high above me.
Can I go now?
Sure.
And we'll talk when I get there?
Yes, we'll talk when you get here.
The sea calls, and that ad from the Royal Caribbean. Hey, you know, it doesn't sound half bad. Ilan Stobbins is talking about something else, though, something you might find out on a wing and a prayer. Here's an evening call to prayer at the Blue Mosque in Istanbul. That, my friend, not Muzak on the Royal Caribbean elevator on the cruise ship. Of course, you know, nice work, nice travel if you can get it. Judy writes to us, Ilan, I wish I had the time, you know, just to get off. It's hard these days. Phyllis says, don't forget that this can apply to domestic travel within the U.S. as much as it does to exotic international locations. Amen to that. I guess you would agree, Ilan. It's not necessarily a matter of how far you go.
Hey, Tom, I think that sometimes simply going to the corner and buying the newspaper can be an eventful journey because of all things that might happen there. Domestic, local, or international, the journey has to have some symmetry between the inside and the outside. I find that commercial that you inserted about the Caribbean incredibly appalling, and yet I can see how alluring can be for many people who are trying to escape. And the key word here is escape, the routine of work, the repetitiveness, the somberness of being in an office without anything that sounds eventful. And eventful is what the tourist industry is trying to offer us. But does it give it to us? Do we end up just going and drinking a margarita and being on a beach for 5 minutes and then returning and turning the television on? It is not so much against the tourist industry. Mm-hmm. I want not to be misunderstood. Mm-hmm. It is against our kind of complacent, kitsch-driven approach to the idea that we need to transport ourselves. We need to be on the move in order to experience something new. Something new can be experienced next door. And if we are going to make the effort to go somewhere else, there is a lot that can happen that we should be ready to engage in. And a lot of that is about discovery, surprise, and the unexpected.
You talk about ego and humility. You say humility is required for genuine travel. You say our outsized egos are a big part of what has shrunk the world. What do you mean by those two?
The second tape that you played, Tom, the mosque, the sound of prayer, immediately generated me a certain type of fear. Would I go to a place and see all people kneeling down? How would I experience that moment? It was the opposite of the first tape that you played.
But why fear? It sounds kind of magical, doesn't it?
It sounds magical in a poster, in a photograph. Not being there and not being part of that religion. I would be the different one. I would be the one not kneeling down. I would have my clothes appear different to the rest. I would have to explain to others that I am not part of that group.
But isn't that the heart of what travel is, to put yourself in just that position?
And that fear is precisely what I was connecting with. It is the fear of being somewhere where I would be looked at as someone different. I am the tourist is as much a fixture of the environment as the people that we as tourists go to see. We transform that environment, and that environment transforms us. And fear is often the result of that encounter, the acknowledgement that we're different, that we're not alike. Are we ready for something like that? That fear might drive me nuts.
Might drive you nuts, but it might also dissolve. I mean, I remember years ago, lucky enough to have time way out on the road on the backside, the east side of Borneo, is not well, out of money, on a coastal boat that had come down and scooped up by a wonderful Muslim family there in Indonesia and taken into their home for 3-4 days. They sort of fed me, nursed me back to health, invited me to their family home back in Java, where they were having a big ceremony, a circumcision ceremony for 2 7-year-old twins in the family, and a huge fiesta there, put me right in the middle of it. You know, there was a fist fight when something went wrong. Uncle ran out by the rice paddies and the women all cooing and soothing him when he went amok. And them accepting me right in the middle of all that, it was the opposite of fear. It was the fear of breaking, giving way to feeling like, wow, I'm at home in this world. Even they're part of it.
And I remember, Tom, being penniless in Europe, not having enough to buy another train ticket, and the only remaining money that I had, I used it to buy a hamburger in McDonald's. And a black family was sitting next to me. We began a conversation, and they ended up hosting me in a gardens house that they had in South London. I lived there for 3 months. I painted their house. I ended up doing all sorts of different jobs in London. And I saw London in a way that I had not seen in the previous 2 weeks. It was thanks to that family in a McDonald's that I was able to recognize an aspect of the city that was alien to me to that point.
We'll take what we can get. But when we break through in travel to something deeper, wow, it's satisfying. Let's hear from our listeners. San Diego, California. Kristen is calling. Kristen, you're on the air with Ilan Stavans. Thanks for calling, Kristen.
Hi. Well, thank you. I just felt like I had to call in as soon as I heard your topic, which is real travel, because I wanted to share an experience that my husband and I had. We sold most of our belongings, quit our jobs in about July of 2008, and spent 16 months driving our car from San Francisco down to the tip of South America, Ushuaia, in Argentina. And it was just an amazing trip. Too hard to even explain. So many amazing people, places we met that we never would have seen if we'd just been on a kind of quote-unquote vacation.
And how did your mentality change as you traveled in that way? I mean, lucky you to be able to do it, but how did your mentality change as you went that way instead of zipping in and out, Kristen?
Well, it just became so much more flexible. We didn't ever plan except for, you know, we'd look ahead and say, we're going to go to this city today, and we'd drive there, and we'd stop and check things out if it looked interesting, and we wouldn't make any reservations, so if we found something along the way that looked better, we'd stop and stay there. Sometimes we'd stay in a place for just a couple of days and take off, and some places we stayed for over a month, depending on what they offered us. So it really depended. but I definitely became a much more kind of flexible and open person throughout the trip.
There you go. There's the kind of soul yoga that goes along with that kind of travel if you're lucky enough to be able to do it. And also, but also brave enough, as Elon points out, and ready to do it. Kristen, thanks for your call from San Diego. One more from Joe in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah. What's your story?
Oh, so my wife and I, we're a pretty young couple, and we have a young daughter, and so we can't really afford to go, you know, to anywhere too exotic. So what we do is we sort of do the opposite. We go within just a few hours of our house, and we, you know, in Tennessee. And most recently, we took a tour of West Tennessee, and we went to Real Foot Lake, and we rented a boat, and we went fishing out on the lake, and it was really an otherworldly experience. I had never been fishing, and I caught several fish. And then my wife has family in the area, and we went over there, and they prepared the fish. It was like getting we go there regularly, but it was the first time we went out on the lake, and it was like getting an entirely different experience, and we weren't that far from home. And,
right.
You know, other times I've traveled, it just, you know, it doesn't feel that unique and that special.
Just be ready to find that other angle, even if it's near home. I love it, Joe, and I hope you caught some good ones. One more. Sivan is calling from Boston. Sivan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
So I'd like to share our experience. We're a family of five now, and every winter vacation we go on a two-week mini adventure once we found out how cheap it is to get to the Caribbeans and Central America. We just take off and spend 2 weeks in a car and stay at roadside hotels without ever checking into these mega resorts. And my second grader and my fourth grader, they always take notes, and then we come back and they share their experiences with their friends. And we always have great adventures without ever checking into the resorts, which we feel have a very bad impact on the local economy. And to check in for them.
And is it affordable the way you've done it? Sivan, a family of five sounds expensive, but maybe not.
Well, no, it's very cheap, actually. I can share numbers with you. We were in the Yucatan Peninsula 3 years ago. That's when we started. We spent $4,500. We were four then. In Panama, we traveled the whole country. We spent about $5,500. And last year, or this year, rather, we went to Jamaica. Again, we traveled the entire island. We were in the Blue Mountains, in the rainforest, in a Rastafari camp, and it was a lot of adventures, and we ended up spending about $6,000. It wasn't, a mega resort. Travel agents always try to convince you to check into a mega resort. They use scare tactics against us, and we know better, luckily, and they were quoting us more for 1 week, you know, all pampered and all inclusive and drinks and all that, but that's not what floats our boat.
So. Sivan, you found your way, and it sounds great. It's not pennies, but it's a lot cheaper than the alternative. Plus, you're out in the middle of the life around you there. Thanks for calling, Sivan. I love all three of those stories. Let me bring Robert Reed in, if I may. Elon, stand by. Robert Reed is a editor, U.S. travel editor for Lonely Planet. He's written 24 Lonely Planet guidebooks. Places all over the world, Colombia, Romania, Moldova, Russia, Vietnam, Trans-Siberian Railway. You can link to his website at ourzonepointradio.org. Robert Reed, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you're in the travel world. This essay by Elon Stabbins and Joshua Ellison must have bounced around your world. What do you think of it? Have we lost sight of something here? Is there some epic travel or just really travel with humility and depth that slipped away from us somehow, Robert?
A lot of times people will ask the travel world, they say, oh, you have the dream job. I would love to do that and go on vacation for a career. And it is different than vacation, what we do. We have a real luxury to be able to essentially be paid to think and write about travel. And basically, anytime you do that, whether it's a story or for a guidebook, you're appointing yourself a quest. And you have to go and research and talk to people. And you get deeper than most people do. And there's lessons from that that you can used for people. But most people, look, you know, America has very few vacation days. You know,
yeah.
France has 15 more vacations a day days than we do.
Wow.
And though the number of passports is rising in America, we're a big place and it's hard for people to go. And a lot of people like to say travel is a self-discovery. And what we just saw in those three calls are mm-hmm. very different ideas of how to do that. I love that because there isn't one way. You know, if someone wants to travel just, you know, I can say this from going back on these trips and talking to friends and family, and I wanted to kind of force my vision of travel on them. And after a while, I kind of stopped because some people don't exactly see it the same way, and that's okay.
Ilan is putting a big value, a premium on the self-discovery part of this and the sink deep in, and he's drawing a contrast between that and, you know, just kind of a getaway that you may need, but he's saying not the same thing and let's not forget it. Do you buy that?
Well, I love it. I believe in it. I do things like that. I crossed the Trans-Siberian, and while I had spare time, I counted mustaches and made graphs to see if I can get trends of mustache trends across Russia and things like that, and just played with it, played with it. I kind of – not really reclaim travel, but you just kind of build travel. And I think the travel writers in general, people who are in the travel industry, should just, as Dylan says, you know, leave the stepping stones behind. Something calls for you. Throw out the stepping stones, not necessarily a template that you have to follow. You know, I mean, if you go back to the history of travel, the first guidebook ever made is in the 12th century. It was French, and it was about the Camino de Santiago, a holy pilgrimage across the north of Spain. And I don't speak French, but what I've read of it is a bit of an attack on Spain, saying, well, the innkeepers are, you know, really going to cheat you, and watch out for people pretending to be lepers because they're going to try to rob you, and saying, if you can deal with the food, then you're stronger than us. So in other words, a lot of people that were going on pilgrimages were going for spiritual wealth, just as explorers were going for material wealth and did all kinds of things. So I don't know if that notion of travel is exactly – was necessarily for self-discovery the same way. I just don't think everybody wants that from travel, and that's okay. But what when I talk about stepping stones, what I love to say is, look, just go to one new place every three trips. You're going to see so much, just like if you go to a rich friend's apartment and you see how they live and you look back at yours and you're going, oh, just going to Cleveland for the first time, going to Laos, you know, just go to a new place every three trips. That will start it, and people will find it. And I love to see people find it for themselves.
Ilan Stavins writes, we might never understand travel as our ancestors did. Our world is too open, relativistic, secular, demystified. But he writes, we will need to reclaim some notion of the heroic, a quest for communion and ultimately self-knowledge. Ilan, do you see the urge to reclaim that, or just to let that go? Get on the beach, get the, you know, get the umbrella drink and forget about it.
I think I see that that desire, at least as a desire, if not as a real possibility. But Tom, I want to invite your listeners and you to think for a second about this need that we have to travel. Not every culture, not every civilization has had the same push to be building an entire industry and be on the move all the time. At no time in history have so many people been on the move as we have today. What would happen if all of a sudden the possibility of travel would disappear? What would we lose? What would we gain? And when we begin to think about that, I think we begin to appreciate also what we have in front of us.
Ilan Stavins is with us. Robert Reed of Lonely Planet. We're talking about real travel. Listeners, you can join us. What trip really took you somewhere else, outside yourself, outside your comfort zone? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK with a little Mongolian horsehead fiddle right there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about real travel, travel versus tourism, and whether real, deep, lose yourself to find yourself travel is something we do anymore, something you do. Ilan Stavins is with us. He and Joshua Ellison wrote a terrific essay, Reclaiming Travel. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. A little chorus of animal sounds behind us there from the Amazon Basin in Peru. Let's listen to a very distinctive voice here, the distinctive voice of old-time, big-time traveler, broadcaster Lowell Thomas. Here he was narrating a 1941 film about the then unexplored Mato Grosso region of Brazil.
We flew over an hour and a half over the barren plateau lands before we spied the waters of the upper Curaçao, whose course we followed to its mouth. On the second flight, we located the Yawalapiti village, hidden in the forest. The rivers follow a very tortuous course through forest and grasslands, and although following them increases greatly the distances that one has to travel, they are the only practical highways.
The only practical highways. Find your highways and byways where you will. Here's a little bit of a street sound from Bangkok. Elon, Robert, we've got terrific feedback from people here. Call Me Missouri says most people can't afford to travel like this because they must be back to their jobs, their slave jobs, calls them on time. This kind of travel requires flexibility. But then we've got also listeners who say, hey, sure. Scooter writes to us, says, each year I travel to the U.S. where I rent a big Harley and tour wherever the less traveled highways take me for 2 weeks with everything I need in the saddlebags, electronics free. I meet all sorts of nice folks as an older woman traveling alone on a big bike. That's a great image. I love it. And one more. Jess says, I was on vacation in Yellowstone, watched a family of six sit all around a table at lunch with iPods and iPhones, not speaking to one another, in the middle of America's one of America's greatest natural gems, staring at the screen to get the latest Facebook update. Well, that is always a risk here, I guess. Hildreth in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my phone call.
Yes.
Yeah, I made two trips to Egypt within a couple of years of each other, and they were just so diametrically different. The first one was independent. I lived in a neighborhood in Cairo and took a month-long Arabic class. And the second one was I took an organized tour. And the first one, I had to do my own grocery shopping. I had to go to the local hardware store, and I had to go to the electronics store to buy a cell phone. And the language differences weren't what really stuck out in my mind. That was the least of my difficulties. You know, every day was an oh my God moment. People really dress like this. They really pray like this. Earlier, you played some call to prayer, and there's a park in Cairo where if you go late in the afternoon, all of a sudden at sunset, every single one of them has muezzin calling really, really loud. And it was just this ethereal experience, you know. But the city was dusty and it was dirty and it was crowded. But then when I took the tour, we were in this little air-conditioned minibus and we went from place to place to place. And I didn't feel like I was even in the same city. In the same country. When we got back to Cairo, I hardly recognized it because I was seeing it with different eyes.
Hildreth, I appreciate the report. There are two trips to Egypt, two ways of doing it, two experiences. Let me get one more, if I may. Thanks, Hildreth. Nashville, Bob, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Yes.
In January, my mom, my wife showed me an article in Backpacker about the Jesus Trail, and 6 weeks later, I was on it. Jesus Trail is a hike from Nazareth to Capernaum, 38 miles, day hikes. I spent one night in Nazareth, or two nights in Nazareth with Muslim brothers. I spent a night with Christian brothers. I spent a night with Jewish brothers. It was such the trip of a lifetime.
And were you walking, backpacking, Bob, all the way? Was this on foot?
Well, the great thing about it is kind of a hybrid here. Yes, it was on foot, but the folks at the Jesus Trail coordinators carried my heavy pack, and so I was able to spend the day hiking with just a day pack. You can hike with a full pack, but I chose to do that with a day pack.
Pretty great combination there. And did it take you somewhere? Did it take your soul somewhere?
Well, I think that the... the interesting thing about it, in January, my job was deleted. So there was a part of me that said, this is crazy, I can't afford to do this, and would not have taken anything for it. And it really wasn't that terribly expensive to do, but for a lifetime, I will know more and understand more. And got me outside my Southern Provincial Baptist bubble and was able to meet an imam, a Muslim a friend carried me to the precipice in his car. We just met at the mosque, White Mosque in Nazareth.
Yeah.
Carried me in his car up, and we ate bananas and tangerines on the precipice and talked about his days as a crewman on a French yacht, and just would not have taken anything for that experience.
Bob, it sounds like a great trip, and we appreciate your sharing it with us. Job deleted, and there you are, the next thing you know, on the Jesus Trail. I mean, people come from all over on this. Ashley says, writes to us here, in September, I'm traveling solo to Turkey for a few weeks, seeking exactly what Professor Stabbins is talking about, discovery, disruption, discomfort, excitement. I'm scared, and I can't wait. But Doc writes us, traveling is an individual experience. You can get as much or little as you like. I'm tired of professional travelers telling me that my cruise is not real travel. I have limited time and limited funds, so I do what I can. Elon, Robert, stand by. Joining us right now from Africa, South Africa, Johannesburg, is Greg Sullivan. He's CEO and co-founder of Afar magazine. It's a travel magazine that espouses authentic travel experiences. Greg Sullivan, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Happy Mandela birthday.
Oh, is it Nelson Mandela's birthday today? All right,
yes,
see?
Yes, it is. Madiba is 94 today.
Now, that you would know in Johannesburg, and I had not thought of sitting here. So what are you packaging up authentic experiences? Is that a contradiction in terms?
No, it's not. Not at all. We think what we can do is help people have amazing experiences by introducing them to fascinating locals and people that are doing incredible things that you could come to Johannesburg and spend a month and not be able to meet some of the people, have the kind of experiences that we try to provide in one of our divisions that we call Afar Experiences, and that's what I'm here working on now.
So what makes it that kind of authentic deal instead of, I don't know, just zipping through, enjoying the sunshine, having a drink, and going home?
Well, like I say, a lot. It's so much about so much of it is about the people, and it's we really. I've been to Johannesburg many times since 2005. Made great friends, lots of people here that we're able to connect you to, people that are chefs, artists, people that are working on AIDS, education, musicians, filmmakers, and these are the kind of people that you're able to meet in 4 days that you would, you know, like I say, leaders of the country that are doing fascinating things that help you really understand the heart and soul of a place.
And are you finding fans for this? Do people want this instead of the package thing?
Oh, absolutely. We started Afar 3 years ago, and we really believe more and more people are looking. Just as Elon's talking about, I think more and more people are looking to get something out of travel. They want to get beyond just the escape. They want to get beyond just the checkbox sightseeing, and they want to come away with something that makes a difference in their lives, that they can remember forever. And as you've said earlier in the program, there's all different kinds of ways to do that. We have a feature in the magazine we call Spin the Globe, where we send a writer somewhere without telling them where they're going until the day they get on a plane. And totally the opposite in some sense. You just show up and let experiences happen. So it's really a mindset is the most important thing, but access to fascinating people is invaluable.
Greg Sullivan with Afar, joining us there from Johannesburg, South Africa. Greg, thanks so much for your time. Wayne in Saranac Lake, New York. Wayne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's your story?
I'm a minister, and I take people on pilgrimage, about 20 of them every year. And we try to go to interesting and novel places. And probably the most interesting place we've been to was Nizamuddin Ali's mosque on Friday.
Where is that, Wayne?
It's in New Delhi.
Okay.
And it was definitely a risk because we were the only white people there, and that alone is an experience of difference. And then when we were there, the women weren't allowed to go into the dargah, the tomb, so they kind of got annoyed. And then the people saw us trying to, kind of go into places we weren't supposed to, and someone inadvertently stepped on a tomb to take a picture, and things were kind of going south really quickly. But I saw the imam, and I waved to him, and he came over, and he asked us what we were there for. And I thought that was a great question, and I said that we were there to pray. And he said, well, that makes all the difference. And so he brought us into the mosque amid, I don't know how many people, hundreds, mm-hmm. And he made a place for us, and he said, you can pray your Christian prayers here. And as a Unitarian, you know, we can pray some other prayers too. So I said we wanted to do zikr with you. And he said, you wanted to pray zikr? And I said, yes. And he said, then we'll all pray with you.
What's zikr, so, Wayne?
Zikr is a prayer in Islam, like the Our Father is in Christianity.
Okay.
And so, but after that happened, then everyone grabbed, pretty much grabbed us and asked us political questions and social questions and practical, personal questions. And people were just, every person was engaged animatedly with someone from the mosque. And instead of it looking like it was going to be a difficult afternoon, it was probably one of the more inspiring afternoons many of these people ever had.
So out of your comfort zone, a little klutzy, but then what, breaking through and very much in a different kind of shared comfort zone.
Fantastic, in fact. I have one question for your guest.
Yeah.
And that is, do they have any special things that they like to do that tend to precipitate a kind of insight experience or an experience of groundedness with this newness or this surprise?
Robert Reed, can you run with that?
Well, you know, that's what the job is. You know, so many times I take a video camera and I try to document something about the place that I'm at, and that leads to unusual stories and things. I use Billy Joel lyrics to look at Long Island. I use them as a guidebook because he frequently sings scenes of Italian restaurant and all these songs. And I went to Saskatoon and asked locals how would they define their place in a few words, and then I made a rap song out of it. So I try to play with the parameters of what travel is. And what that is basically using research and like what you would do to go and document something. It doesn't matter what it is. The process of that gets you under the surface in a way that most travelers won't get, and it's very easy. All you have to do is ask.
Elon Stobbins, what about you? How do you get grounded, get close, break through, get that extra intimacy?
It is always arbitrary and surprising, and it depends on the occasion, and I would not in any way want to be prescriptive about how to get an insight. But I wanted to say something about all this that you're asking, Tom, and always doing it in such insightful and provocative ways, and the many guests that you have had in this show. An essential component of travel is the language that we use to describe it, the way we come back and articulate our thoughts, as we have been doing in this show, about what we experience. The articulation is not the experience itself. The way that story was just delivered is in and of itself magical. I am sure that the experience was magical, but the delivery is something altogether different. And I think it is very important to keep in mind that travel is not only going, but thinking about going and talking about going and coming up with ways to describe what went on with us. And those ways to describe change as we change. The same trip today described by this speaker might be described very differently in 2 weeks or in a year or in 5 years because his life will change and his memories will change as well. Travel moves as we move. Memories are transformed as we grow up.
I'm struck by the role of vulnerability in all this. I mean, we tend to try to set it all up in advance, you know, and have every element of the trip planned out very often. But in my experience, you know, I spent maybe 10 years abroad. It was the moments of real vulnerability where, as many of our listeners allude, where people all over the world come out and you feel that embrace. And suddenly in your vulnerability, you're closer to them, to their culture. Shaheen is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Shaheen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to share, I travel a lot with my 8-year-old daughter and my husband all around the world, different cities, and two things that have gotten us out of town in a day. We Google off the beaten path, enter the city, and we get a slew of recommendations of what to do outside of cities. And then we take a bus or a train to a destination we don't know, don't have a map for, get off, and just explore. And we've seen flamingo parks outside Dubai. We've seen deserted towns preparing for summer season in Vienna. We've discovered an underground town underneath a Victorian ski lodge in Murray, Pakistan, in the mountains.
Wow.
It's been great. Graffiti roads, artists outside Sao Paulo. And it's just a great way. You don't need to know the language. Ask for a bottle of water from someone, and you're on your way.
But does it mean you miss the big sights, the big, you know, the Taj Mahal, the Vienna Opera House? You're on the end of the subway line.
We do one day and pick one or two things. We don't try to be ambitious, things that would fit with our 8-year-old as well as appease what the adults want. And then another day or half day, or we pick an evening or a morning, split it half day, or one day and another day, and do an off-the-beaten-track excursion.
Shaheen,
and that way we get a bit of both worlds.
It sounds like your family is on to a pretty good path there. Pretty great if you can do it, and it sounds like you are. Thanks for your call, Shaheen. Ilan, parting advice for our listeners thinking about their own travel plans near or far, maybe this summer even?
Maybe the last thought is a stanza from a poem by Elizabeth Bishop called One Art, just the first one that reads, "The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster." Loss is an essential part of travel, and loss is also gain.
Even getting lost, at least for a while. Ilan Stavin's essay is Reclaiming Travel. He wrote it with Joshua Ellison. He joined us from Amherst, Massachusetts today. Professor of Latin American and Latino Culture at Amherst College. Author of On Borrowed Words. Ilan Stavins, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today. Happy trails to you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being again in the show.
And Robert Reed, U.S. travel editor for Lonely Planet. Robert, thanks so much for your time and insights.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Happy trails to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.